is on the air thanks to listener donations and generous support from the University of Southern Maine. MASM educates Maine's future artists, business people, engineers, healthcare professionals, lawyers, managers, public servants, scientists, and teachers. More information is available at usm.maine.edu.
Blunt wishes to thank the following sponsors and partners: the A.R. Gould School at Long Creek Youth Development Center, Terrascope Youth Radio at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Youth Radio from Youth Media International in Oakland, California.
The views expressed on Blunt are those of the individual producers and not those of WMPG, the University of Southern Maine, or any of Blunt's funders and supporters. Blunt Youth Radio welcomes opposing views.
It's 12 noon in London, 7 a.m. in Philadelphia.
Somewhere. It has to start sometime. What better place than here? What better time than now?
What's your contribution going to be? What problems are you going to solve? What discoveries will you make?
I intend to broadcast from this ship 24 hours a day until the day I die. And for a couple days after that.
No one's written your destiny for you. You make your own future.
I've always lived for news and weather. Happy to die for them too. Especially the weather.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Blunt Youth Radio Show, an award-winning youth radio show airing live every Monday evening. I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Gabby Farrell. And tonight we're talking to you as intersectional feminists about what intersectionality and feminism means to us and our community. Many of you may know what feminism is, which, for clarity, is different groups of people working for the equality of all genders and challenging systems of oppression and patriarchy. But what is intersectionality?
Intersectionality is a way of thinking about feminism that has been around since the 80s, but many people don't know what it means. The Wikipedia page defines it by saying, "Intersectionality, or intersectionalism, is the study of intersections between different disenfranchised groups and groups of minorities, specifically the study of the interactions of multiple systems of oppression and discrimination."
And that's a pretty intellectual way of describing intersectionality. And today on the show, we'll be speaking with three guests to help us decode those ideas. Our guests this evening are Katie Zema, a women and gender studies student at USM, Wendy Chapkis, author and the director of Women and Gender Studies Department at the University of Southern Maine, and Emran Siddiqui, the director of social media and outreach for misrepresentation, an organization that looks at representations of women in the media. Lots of long, long words.
Blunt is a call-in show. Please call us with your thoughts and questions, and we will put you on the air. The number is 780-4909, that's 780-4909, and we'd like to hear from our listeners about what feminism means to them or what they think it means. So now with us, we have...
Wendy Chapkis is with us right now in studio, and we also have Katie Zema on the phone. Wendy Chapkis is, as we said, a professor of sociology and the director of Women and Gender Studies here at USM in Portland. She's written and co-authored two books and has written many articles about sex work and the lives of women all over the world. And we also have Katie Zema, I believe,
who is currently studying women and gender studies and sociology at the University of Southern Maine. Katie has been actively involved in queer and feminist advocacy in the Southern Maine area through working for the Mainers United for Marriage campaign last year and serving on the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. Southern Maine Board, so many long words for everything here, advocating for gender equality and bringing an end to violence against women has always been one of her biggest passions.
So welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
And Katie?
Is Katie on the phone with us?
I am. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Loud and clear, Katie. Hello.
Okay, good.
Katie, you're in New York right now, so you're joining us over the phone. All right.
Fantastic. I'm in Syracuse, New York right now, so...
Oh, wonderful. All right.
So for the both of you, we both started the show here just talking about the general definition of intersectional feminism. But we would like to hear from both of you. What does that mean to you as individuals?
Would you like to start, Katie?
Sure, yeah. I guess to me, always that intersectionality is just really just literally is intersecting just different, you know, human qualities, you know, sexuality and gender identity and race and religion and socioeconomic, you know, backgrounds, and basically how all of those kind of layer up. And I can't remember who it was who I studied who, you know, talked about the matrix of domination and oppression and things like that. But I remember that was basically just talking about, you know, the different layers of privilege that we have in society and basically how those intersect and, you know, that you can be of a racial minority but, you know, come from a strong economic background and basically how all of those intersect to create, you know, how much privilege you have or don't have in society.
Nice definition. Okay, so this is Wendy. And when I think of intersectionality, I think about the impossibility of deciding who we are by naming it through only one difference. Mm-hmm. So am I a woman? Yes. Am I a professional? Yes. Am I queer? Yes. Am I getting to be an elder? Yes. So each one of those differences impacts on what it means to be any of the other ones. So mm-hmm. the kind of woman that I am is affected by my age, by my race, by my class position, by my sexual orientation, by my nationality, by my religion, and so forth and so on. There's no way to say, well, I'm just a woman. I'm a very particular kind of woman.
That's very true. So this is another question that either or both of you can answer, which is, what was your first introduction to feminism, and were you immediately drawn into it, or where did you first kind of get the...
What was your first tasting of feminism?
Yeah. For me, that was a long mm-hmm. time ago. Well, I was... I'm almost 60 now, so when I first went to the university, when I was an undergraduate, is in the early 1970s, and it was right when the second wave of the women's movement in this country was exploding. And it was by far the most interesting thing going on campus, I thought. And mm-hmm. so I went to a consciousness-raising group, which was a very popular thing in the 1970s. Women would put up signs around campus saying they wanted to start a CR group. And maybe there would be 8 or 10 people that would get together once a week and talk. And we would talk about, oh, maybe the topic for the night might be your family. So you talk about your relationships to your mother and your father and your siblings and how that impacted on who you were as a young woman. Or you would talk about sex, and you talk about domestic violence or rape. And so everybody would talk from their own experience. And I was sure when I went to my first CR group that I was going to hate everybody in the room because I thought women were kind of uninteresting. It was boys in high school that seemed much more interesting to me, and they were serious, and I was going to be serious, and I wasn't going to be sitting around with a bunch of girls talking about clothes. And it actually turned out to be profound. And when I realized that, oh, I shared a whole lot in common with everybody else in that room, and the people that I wasn't so much sharing things in common with were interesting and people I wanted to get to know better, I thought, okay, feminism, that has something for me.
And what about you, Katie?
I like to say I always thought feminism seemed like a great idea, but I remember sharing this story in one of my classes this past semester, that, you know, when I first went away to school, I went to a little bit more of a conservative school, and I remember sitting around with a group of women, and someone was talking about feminism, and she said, you know, it's probably a group of about 20 women, and they said, you know, how many in here would say that you're a feminist? And I remember, you know, putting my hand up in the room and being the only one and watching, you know, every girl, you know, is like, oh, you know, I think, you know, I would not call myself a feminist. You know, those are women who believe that they're above men and that, you know, and so it's basically that I just was like, okay, you know, all of a sudden I didn't, you know, it was like, what is this? You know, is feminism not this big, strong thing? And since moving back to Portland and becoming involved, you know, with the Women and Gender Studies program at USM, which has just opened my mind so much and done so much for me, it's about empowerment and it's about, you know, gender equality and just really knowing that, you know, that gender is not a binary and that it is just, there's so much more to that. And I think, you know, I guess like the biggest story to me is just empowerment and that it's about equality and knowing that everyone, you know, should have an equal opportunity, you know, regardless of their gender, regardless of their race or their age or their religion or anything, bring it back to intersectionality though. But that's sort of my, you know, realizing that feminism is pretty a really awesome thing.
You said, you know, that it was kind of, you identified as feminist and then were thinking, well, maybe not, maybe this isn't as right as I thought. So what did make you choose to be a women and gender studies major once you came to USM?
Well, I took some time off and I worked for the Mainers United for Marriage campaign. And I met some amazing people there that really changed my mind and gave me some awesome books to read. Read some Virginia Woolf and some Audre Lorde and said, man, these are some awesome ladies who really knew what they were talking about. And then just, you know, kind of almost on a whim, I was living in Portland at the time to, you know, enroll in the program. And, you know, I just remember becoming so immersed in it and just loving so much and just looking forward to my classes and, you know, each thing that I was going to read, I just felt like my mind was constantly being reshaped and reopened to thinking about so many parts of my everyday life in a different way.
Now, you mentioned earlier and when you'd first, you mentioned that you'd heard people saying things like, well, I wouldn't call myself a feminist, but, I know I've encountered people who say they don't choose to use the word feminism because it sounds too exclusive. What are your thoughts on that? And what do you say to people if you talk to people who say these things? What do you say to people who voice legitimate criticisms of feminism?
I say feminism is not a religion. Mm-hmm. It's a critical perspective. And so if you don't like what you're hearing that's being called feminist, challenge it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say similar things, you know. Feminism to me, being a feminist is definitely, you know, a part of my identity that, you know, is very strong for me. And I was in the kitchen one day, and I was talking to my dad, and I said, you know, Dad, are you a feminist? And he said, well, what is a feminist? You know, define that to me. And I just said very simply, you know, it's someone who believes in equality for all genders. And he said, yeah, then I think so. And it was very simple, you know, and I mean, I think that's where really my perspective changed is when it's not about, you know, it's not, you know, patriarchy or matriarchy. It's not one gender dominating over the other. It's about equality, you know. That's sort of what it comes down for me.
Yeah, and so you say that feminism is really part of your identity, and I know you're majoring in women and gender studies. So do you have any post-graduation plans as to anything you're super passionate about or thinking about what you might want to do with your degree or anything of that nature?
I think I'm always thinking about that. I think one of my biggest passions in all of this is looking, you know, you mentioned violence against women and looking at rape culture and just that, you know, sexual assault and sexual violence is such an issue, you know, in our society. And I think that it just often gets quieted and often, you know, goes unspoken about. And I think trying to, you know, shadow that silence and, you know, bringing power back to women and men who have been affected by that. So I would love to, you know, go into advocacy about that and, you know, sort of fight against that issue. But I think one thing I've realized in studying both, you know, women and gender studies and sociology is that there's so much, and there's so much that you can learn. And I'm constantly, you know, reshaping and finding new passions and new interests. And I'm sure that that will continue as I continue on at USM.
Now, what is something, you know, you're clearly studying this, Katie, and you, Wendy, this is part of your job is to talk about this, but what would you say to people who are interested in getting into feminism and could you talk a little bit about what you can do if you're really passionate about social justice and intersectional feminism? What you can do with that knowledge?
Do you want to start, Katie?
I guess, I mean, I think, you know, I think that there is so much that you can do. I mean, my mind has opened up so much, you know, and I think, the tone that I've heard some of my, you know, friends who are also, you know, women in gender studies, you know, majors call it, you know, the feminist killjoy, that you're watching something on TV, you're listening to the radio, and, you know, these songs, you know, I always get critiqued because, you know, there are so many, like, rap songs that I love, and I'm just like, you know, the blatant misogyny in it, you know, has just become so, so much more aware to me since that, and I think that it does sort of reshape your mind, but I think you can use it as a chance, you know, to teach other people and to show them, and I think there's so much, you know, material out there, and there's so many ways to learn about this, and, you know, I think it just, there's so much more than just, you know, reading, you know, Jezebel online, which is kind of how I started, you know, first, you know, getting really into feminism, and I think that it's just a tool to really reshape, you know, how you've been socially constructed, you know, growing up in so many ways.
Something that I would suggest in addition to all of that is just resurrecting the consciousness raising group and get together with 5 or 6 friends and sit around and have a cup of tea and talk about who you are and how you became who you are. Mm-hmm. And it's really mind-blowing to hear your stories echoed in your community. And if your stories are different, that's really useful to hear about too. And the other thing is show up at every opportunity to engage in social activism, mm-hmm. around social justice and equality. I know I saw you all there just a few minutes ago. There was a big demonstration in response to the Trayvon Martin killing and the Zimmerman verdict. And it was, for me, feminist activism. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. what intersectionality is about. It's you bring all of who you are to the fight for greater social equality. And one of the moments in that demonstration that was most moving for me, or very profound for me, was there was a clearly a mentally ill man in the crowd who was screaming obscenities and racist comebacks to the people on the stage. And a whole group of us, who I know from Women and Gender Studies at USM, students, alumni, and faculty and staff from this campus, immediately came and stood in front of him and created a barrier between him and the speakers.
Yeah, I saw that.
And
yeah.
I thought, oh, and it didn't seem coincidental to me at all that it was, mm-hmm. Women and Gender Studies, mm-hmm. students, faculty, and staff who were standing there doing, and alumni who were standing there and doing that, because that is what you do when you're a feminist. Mm-hmm. That's what you do when you're a social justice advocate.
Yeah, that was really awesome to see. And I know, Katie, you mentioned you're really passionate about ending violence against women and rape culture. Could you give our listeners a definition of what rape culture is and why it's so harmful?
Yes, I can try. Recently, probably just in the last year, you know, heard the term rape culture, and it really, you know, opened up to me, and I think in the original email you sent me, you also mentioned the term casual sexism, which to me, like, really what rape culture is it's just, you know, that sexual assault and sexual violence have almost just become a casual part of our culture, you know, and that, you know, victim blaming, you know, and taking things into consideration of, like, what a woman was wearing or, you know, if she was drinking and things like this, you know, are just so common. And I think that also, you know, listening to music and just the fact of, you know, objectifying women are just such a part of our culture that, you know, that's why, you know, rape and sexual assault and just sexual violence are just not taken with the seriousness, you know, and that they should be. That's kind of sort of a rough definition. Wendy, I'm sure you have a much better one.
No, I think that was beautifully said. Yeah. It's a culture of violence against women that's normalized.
And I think I would like to define for our listeners a little bit that, you know, there's often jokes made. I feel like I've personally heard a lot of rape jokes, and I often tell people, don't say those things.
Yeah.
But that's casual, and it's just, it's a huge part of our culture is sexual violence, especially against women. So that's what rape culture is.
Yeah. I think kind of with it being like a joke or being casual, what was really upsetting for me is, you know, it's become such a casual thing when, like, a lot of elementary school age kids will be, they'll all giggle and say, like, oh, if you touch my belly button for 12 seconds, then you raped me. Like, that, it's just crazy, the things that these, like, 9-year-olds, and I don't know where they're getting it from, but clearly, like, it's become such a big problem that, like, if 9-year-olds are making jokes like that, it's...
And, you know, the media is a huge part of this. There's what's coming to mind personally right now is the Oscars for this year. There's the so-called comedian Seth MacFarlane made this whole joke about seeing women topless in movies, and the whole joke was that you get something, or
and he was just pointing at women in the audience who, like, we saw your boobs, and I remember hearing from someone, like, at least 3 of the movies that he was referencing were, like,
sexual assault scenes. But that's also part of rape culture, and that's also about media portrayals of that and how we see women and what's the popular part of media. And we need to intro our guests that can talk to us about this subject. We have with us Imran Siddiqui, who works for Misrepresentation. They are the director of social media and outreach at misrepresentation.org, and they have worked there for 2 years developing their online community and reaching millions throughout social media activism. Hello, Imran. Are you on the line? All right. We'll be getting to you.
Maybe.
We'll be talking to you soon. I think there's a slight technical difficulties issue right now. We'd like to talk... Imran, all right, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Welcome. And again, listen.
Hi.
All right. So we were just talking a little bit about women in the media and how they're represented and how that might add, how we view women in the media and talk about women in the media might add to cultural violence against women. And we know that you worked with Misrepresentation, and Misrepresentation is a film about representation of women in media. And today we're exploring the intersectionality and how presses operate differently for different groups of people. In your film or your organization, do you look at whether the media portrays women of different races or classes differently?
Yeah, it's definitely something that we focus a lot of our work now on, is looking at intersectionality and how this affects different groups. I noticed, so right as I was coming on, I overheard you talking about the Oscars and how the host, used the opportunity to, demean women. But he made a joke about the 9-year-old woman who is a young girl who is nominated for Best Actress.
Yes, yeah.
And it was a very, not only was it a sexist joke, but it felt like a very racial moment,
yeah,
too. I mean, and so the discussion that we had on our Facebook page, and which is a lot of where we do a lot of amazing, we have an amazing community of women and men, of different types of people talking about these issues, and you often find some of the smartest people that I hear from are on our Facebook page. But yeah, so we try to talk about these issues frequently as possible, because we really feel like social media is one of the ways that we're actually changing the mainstream narrative, because where voices are marginalized in mainstream media, where women are not heard, and especially women of color, we can give them voice, we can amplify their voice, and as our movement grows and our community grows, we're able to provide that more and more. And so I'm a really strong believer in the power of social media to challenge and change the way women are represented in the mainstream.
Yeah, and so I know misrepresentation is about critiquing how mainstream media represents women, and your role at Misrepresentation is the director of social media. So how have you utilized social media to try and reshape how women are represented or to try and mobilize activism around that?
So we do a lot of different things. I mean, one of the campaigns that we have is called Not Buying It, and basically it started as a hashtag on Twitter, and folks would use it to let companies know doing something that was sexist, that they weren't going to be purchasing that item. And so initially it started around the Super Bowl in 2012, and it grew into something much larger during the game because, the Super Bowl happens to be, you know, the most watched TV event of the year in America. It also happens to be this huge media event. And so we also, maybe not ironically, we have some of the most sexist commercials during the Super Bowl. And so we asked people to use Not Buying It, the hashtag, whenever they saw something that was problematic and representing gender. And, you know, it ended up reaching over 1 million people that first year. And this year we did it again, and it's reached 4 million people. And what it does is it gives people an outlet to talk about the sexist media that they're seeing in real time. And we've then used that hashtag to actually get companies to respond, to pay attention to their consumers, and to take action. So in the past, we've gotten T-shirts pulled from Amazon.com. We've got Harrods in London to stop selling gendered books. And it's all because, you know, the media, I think, often forgets that in America, at least 85% of consumer purchasing decisions are in the hands of women. And so for so long, they've been speaking just to men. And what we're just kind of using social media to do through campaigns like Not Buying It is to let consumers directly tell and remind the media that, you know, a lot of different people buy their products and watch their commercials and watch their TV shows and whatnot. And they all deserve to be heard and to be given equal representation. And so we're actually turning Not Buying It into an app now, and so by the end of the year we'll be able to have an even more powerful tool to give consumers voice in that way.
Now,
that's awesome. Yeah.
Do you think that you know, I know that teens are definitely, I believe at least, are a large part of the consumer culture. So do you think, you know, making this app and stuff like that is definitely a way to talk about the representation of women and sort of bring young people to that?
Yeah, I think that.
Or educate young people about, younger, you know, people such as myself about these issues by making it more relevant, especially by using social media to talk about this representation of women?
Exactly. I mean, that's another huge advantage. I mean, it's young people, and also, I mean, the majority of the users on social networks like Facebook are women. And so in particular, we get to reach young women who are, again, not usually heard in the mainstream. And so there's two things happening at young people in general wanting to have their opinions heard and their voices heard, and all of us when we're younger probably feel like we're not heard. But on top of that, there's the reality that young women are being actually represented poorly or underrepresented or not represented at all. And so social media offers a direct way to solve.
Sorry, I have to stop you there. Imran Siddiqui, thank you very much. You're Imran from Misrepresentation. We've been talking with Wendy Chapkis and Katie Zima. I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
This is Gabby Farrell.
We're Blunt News Radio. We'll be right back after the break.
Friday night, you and your boys went out to eat.
But you came home around three.
She did.
If six of y'all went out, then four of you were really cheap. Yeah. Cause only two of you had dinner. I found your credit card receipt. It's not right, but it's okay.
Tonight, the weather tonight will be, we'll see a chance of showers with thunderstorms also possible after 2 a.m. It's going to be cloudy with a low around 63, northeast wind around 5 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 50%, so, you know, could go either way. New rainfall amounts between a tenth and a quarter of an inch, so, you know, nothing substantial. And higher amounts possible during thunderstorms.
Tomorrow, showers likely. Then showers and possibly a thunderstorm after 5 p.m., a high near 74 degrees Fahrenheit. North wind around 5 miles per hour, becoming east in the afternoon. A chance of precipitation is 80%. New rainfall amounts between a quarter and a half of an inch possible. Tuesday night, showers likely mainly before 10 p.m., cloudy with a low around 64. Southeast wind around 5 miles per hour, becoming west after midnight. Chance of precipitation is 60%. New precipitation amounts between a tenth and a quarter of an inch possible.
Then Wednesday, it's going to be pretty sunny, and it's going to be around 76 degrees. It's going to be not particularly windy either, but in the night, the wind's going to pick up a little bit, around 10 miles per hour, with a low around 58, so Wednesday night will be a good night to be out and about.
All right, hello, and welcome back to Blunt Youth Radio Project.
Hi, I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Gabby Farrell, and tonight we've been talking about intersectional feminism with our guests, Wendy Chapkis, who's with us in studio, who's the director of the Women and Gender Studies Department at USM, and we talked to Katie Zema, who I don't think is online with us anymore.
No, and she was student at USM in Portland studying women and gender studies.
And also still with us is Emran Siddiqui from Misrepresentation, which is an organization that talks about the representation of women in the media. Emran, are you still with us?
Yep, still here.
Awesome.
All right, thank you for being with us. And we were talking before our break about women's representation, and we have a piece by our Blunt News Radio reporter, Adam Bradstreet. He did a piece about women's representation or underrepresentation in video games, and we would like to play this piece and talk about it with you. All right, here's the piece by Adam Bradstreet. All right, it will be a little bit of technical difficulties again.
We're going to hear it in just a moment.
Just a moment. So I was trying to talk about how youth, like ourselves, and maybe, Wendy, you can also comment about this, that how younger people can get involved in talking about these everyday things that deeply affect us, that are all feminist issues. And I know you, Amram, we're talking about you have outreach through your Facebook pages, just basic social media stuff, and you have an app and stuff like that that really gets people to get involved. And there's this projects like Not Buying It. And I was wondering if, Wendy, you know of any other projects like that or have any suggestions for people getting involved?
Well, one of the things that I think is fun to do and helps kind of break the notion that feminists are humorless is to have conversations when you see a movie about not simply, oh my God, it was so sexist, but to simply ask whether the film passed what's called the Bechdel test. And that is, does it have two women in it? Do they both have names? Do they talk to each other? And do they talk to each other about something other than men? And it's a great conversation opener when you get out of a movie, because one of the shocking things is you sort of go through the list and you go, oh my God, no, it didn't pass that very, very simple test. And for me, that's a kind of an interesting conversation starter then. It's like, wow, what does it mean that major Hollywood films, vast numbers of them, don't feature two women? They don't have names. They don't talk to each other, or they don't talk about anything other than a guy.
I just went to a new movie that was just released. It was, action movie, very fun to watch. But there is really only two women in the entire movie, really, and that both had names. They never talked to each other. And one of them was only seen very briefly, and the other was in a sort of submissive role. And then everyone else, there was a few background women.
Was this Pacific Rim?
Yes, I saw that too, and went, oh no!
I
personally found that movie very enjoyable, but it was incredibly disappointing to not see that. But I love the term feminist killjoy a little bit, because I think that's a funny way of talking about critiquing media especially. But yeah, you're enjoying, you're killing the joy, but at the same time, it's sometimes it can be funny, I feel like, to criticize things for how bad they are.
Yeah,
but
and with the the Bechdel test and how vast majority of books and movies and television shows all have a male star, is the problem is once things do pass the Bechdel test, like The Heat with Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock, which was hilarious. I very highly suggest going and seeing that. I was crying the whole time from laughter. But the problem is that, from what I've heard, is that big movie executives, they don't want to produce movies that are only starring women, because the misconception is that women and men will consume media that stars men, but men won't read a book with a female character. Female main character, or men won't watch a movie with two female main characters. But I know from personal experience that it's not true.
Well, that's like wrong. You know, can come up with little examples like The Hunger Games, for instance.
Exactly.
But, which I mean, possibly could be a quote bad example, because it's very action packed, and so she's in the traditional what could often be read as a male role in the book and movie. But, I mean, I think a part of the issue that we always see, the white guy as the protagonist for everything, is that they can, the white guy is allowed to experience every story and everything in this whole world because they are the real human, quote, the true humans, and everybody else is secondary subhumans. And so we only get very specific types of stories that...
I've always thought that we need a companion to the Bechdel test that is a sort of racial Bechdel test.
Yes. Yeah.
Are there two people of color in the film? Do they both have names? Do they talk to each other? They talk about something other than white people.
Yes.
And as an aside, I think, you know, your observation that the studios feel men won't go to see films that star women or have women as the protagonists, I think it's the same thing around white audiences and people of color. And one of the easy things that we can do, sort of the enjoyable political interventions, is go see those films that don't star white men, and that we can all do that. We can all make that.
I know myself, you know, I'm reaching a point in my media discussion at my media viewership at the age of 16. I'm already done with everything that doesn't have more diverse characters in it. So I was very frustrated when I found out that the movie Pacific Rim like only had two women in it, but I wasn't gonna start boycotting all action movies because it stars Idris Elba as a black man who was one of the main characters, though he wasn't the main character as advertised, which was disappointing. But we need to talk about our feature, which talks a lot about this, and I think it may even mention the Bechdel test. So again, we have a feature by Adam Bradstreet talking about women's representation or underrepresentation in video games. So here's the piece.
The gaming industry is entering its eighth generation, featuring advances in new technology and storytelling. And for eight generations, games have been primarily focused on the cis white male protagonist. Surely gaming today features more diversity, more women protagonists. Given that women make up 45% of all gamers, why then, if nearly half of all gamers are women, do so few games actually feature women? Why is it that the gaming industry and many of its male players insist that women do not compromise a significant part of the gaming community? Not only are women underrepresented in the gaming community, they are underrepresented in the field of video game developing. In a July 2013 Wall Street Journal piece by Ian Schur, they wrote, "Video game developers say women are often underrepresented among their ranks. Ubisoft said 18% of its 7,100-person production team are women, as are 27% of its top managers. The argument has long been that developers create games that sell, but if games are not created featuring women, then those games cannot be purchased or played. So this is a circular argument, and it speaks to sexism that permeates gaming culture. For example, a new game, The Last of Us, is a game that has been praised as one of the best games of the year, so much so that it's seen as a model for women in games. While the game features female characters, many of the female characters are killed off early in the game, or they are minor characters to begin with. The main protagonist is Joel, a conflicted white guy who is softened up by Ellie, a secondary female character who reminds him of his daughter, the one that dies at the very start of the game. Ellie can only be played through one part of the chapter in the story, and the entire time she's being taught to be strong by the protagonist white male. That The Last of Us is being held up as a model game for strong female characters seems hugely problematic, given that it supports numerous sexist tropes. With PlayStation 4, a newly announced next-gen console, out of all the first-party and third-party games, 42 of them total, 38 feature male protagonists, and only one, Mirror's Edge 2, features a female protagonist. Sexism in games is not all just about the games, but the culture around it. Sexism in gaming culture was highlighted in last year when Anita Sarkeesian, who produces a video web series called Feminist Frequency, in which she critiques and explores how women are represented in media and pop culture, was harassed with violent and sexual verbal attacks after she began a Kickstarter campaign to fund her web series. Which is how critique happens in gaming culture. It's not critique based on ideas. When women protest sexism in gaming culture, the counterattacks are swift, often violent, and almost always sexual, if not sexually violent. In Anita Sarkeesian's case, she actually received death threats, all because she, as a woman gamer, has something to say about the way in which women are represented in games and the lack of representation of women as a whole. In my research for this piece, I read something that was very telling regarding how women are perceived in media. When a video game developer was interviewed by Wall Street Journal about his changing a few lines of code so that he could play as Princess Peach in his version of Super Mario Bros., he said, People ask me why I didn't change Super Mario Bros. To Super Peach Sisters, he says, but he didn't want a game that was unequal. I wanted to have the same game, but you know, you can play as the girl. And that's just it. The lack of women represented in gaming is appalling, but not only is it a problem in gaming culture, it's a problem in all media, which makes up a significant portion of American culture. In June of this year, only one movie with several primary female characters was treated to a wide theater release, and two other movies were only in indie film theaters. Linda Holmes, reporting for NPR, wrote, I want to stress this again. In many, many parts of the country right now, if you want to go to see a movie in the theater and see a current movie about a woman, any story about any woman that isn't a documentary or a cartoon, you can't. You cannot. There are not any. You cannot take yourself to one, take your friend to one, take your daughter to one. There are not any. This July, only about 15% of movies released feature women, most of which barely pass the Bechdel test, which states that two women must be named and talk to each other about something other than a man. Even if the movie passes the test, it does not mean it features lead female characters. The lack of lead female characters in film and games is terrible. Women make up half the people on the planet, and they need to be represented in media. And people not even acknowledging the lack of representation is worse. When, according to a recent study that examined the ratio of men and women in groups, and they found that there's 17% women, the men in the group think it's 50-50. And if there's 33%, the men perceive that there is being more women in the room than men. That's a problem, and its name is sexism. I think this is from the actor Gina Davis from her Institute on Gender and Media. This is Adam Bradstreet reporting from Blunt Youth Radio.
Hey, welcome back. It's Sean from the DTTA Boys.
You are listening to WMPG and W281AC Gorham, Portland.
Hello, and we're back. I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
I'm Gabby Farrell.
And we are talking about intersectional feminism this evening. And we just listened to a piece by Adam Bradstreet, and he reported for us, did a commentary about sexism and women's underrepresentation in video games. And with us, you know, he brought up some points, you know, about how men perceive, you know, a small group of women being 50-50, a slightly larger group of women is the majority. And I feel like that's how people feel in video games, as he was talking about The Last of Us, secondary female character who's barely in the game as a strong character. It's seen as a revolutionary video game. And with us right now, we have Emran Siddiqui, who is the director of social media outreach at Misrepresentation, who talks about this. So, do you have any thoughts about any of those points Adam made in his piece?
Yeah, a lot of great points there. I think I highly recommend anyone, as Adam mentioned, Anita Sarkeesian's Feminist Frequency mm-hmm. series does a great job of going in depth into the problems representations of women in video games and looking at particularly this idea of tropes. So even when you have women in games, you know, it's such a small number, but even when they're there, they're often used in such stereotypical ways that it's not really helping. I think that's an important issue. And this idea that, you know, if we have one, often folks will point out that somehow is 50-50 or enough, you know, but the statistics just don't lie. You know, we know that protagonists in films are under 17% and that, you know, the impact of that, and this is one of the points of our film Misrepresentation, is that it's not just, you know, about the movies we watch and the media we consume, but the real world impact of that is that Congress is 20% female, and it has been for our entire history, you know, and so we've never actually had 50% representation in our government. And so, you know, when we say that, when people try to dismiss these issues as media issues or as, you know, even as video game issues, there's a real world impact. And our kids are growing up and our youth grow up not seeing women in leadership positions. And that means they don't have the same, both for women and men, for girls and boys, we don't see women in the same way as we see men. And mm-hmm. the real-world impact is that we lack female leadership. And so And yeah, I thought it's a bigger issue than just than video games, you know?
And, you know, as you're talking about something called the Smurfette Principle, as Anita Sarkeesian, runner of Feminist Frequency, has talked about, is that one female character represents all women, which I think is a greater issue, or it is, that is the issue, but it's a issue within all media, is that we'll have one black guy, one woman, right, one person of color, whatever. We'll have one person who's gay, and they will represent everyone that's not a white guy, and will, because, you know, everyone who's like that is the same, obviously, says the media. And that sort of brings us into stereotypes about people and just not seeing each individual as a full individual human being, and not seeing non-white people who are not white and people who are not specifically cis men as full human beings who have a right to life. And so this evening, as part of our feminism, I think, I'll speak for both of us, we went to a rally about, that was talking about
The Trayvon Martin case.
The Trayvon Martin case and the Zimmerman verdict. It was called Join Us in a Call to Remember, to Honor, to Act, an event which was in response to Zimmerman, where we saw the head of the NAACP of Maine, the mayor of Portland, and many leading members of religious organizations in Maine talk about abolishing laws like the Stand Your Ground laws in order to ensure safety for all individuals. So we were there, and we were listening to people.
Yeah, it was in Monument Square. There was a pretty large crowd of people, lots of signs, and there was a stage where people were coming up and kind of saying their piece about the trial. And I think we have a feature with some sound bites that we got from the rally, which we're going to play right now.
Hello. Hello. We're from Blunt Youth Radio Project here in Portland, Maine, and we're going around and we're talking to people at this event. So why are you here today, and why is this an important event to you?
I'm Marvin Ellison, by the way. I'm president of the Religious Coalition Against Discrimination, which has been around about 30 years. And it's a statewide network of faith leaders, clergy and others, who work to do education and advocacy for human and civil rights, especially for LGBT persons. But LGBT struggles for justice are also anti-racism struggles, they're anti-poverty struggles, they're ecological justice struggles. We're all connected around these issues. So when violence is done to any part of our community, we need to stand up and say, this has to stop. It's not right that a young man walking home could not get there safely without being killed. It's really an outrage, and it matters to people here in Portland, Maine, as much as it matters to people in Sanford, Florida, and all across the country. How could we not be here?
Is that
all right? So that was a clip from
the rally, talking
from
to
the rally,
an attendee who was there from his organization, the Religious Coalition to Prevent.
And he made some good points, and you know, points are being voiced, I think, by generally a lot of people that we spoke to or overheard. Just the idea that a human being was violently attacked for existing, and that needs to not happen again, and we need to recognize that and make that part of our lives, is to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Right, and I think a big part of that case was racial profiling, which I think we probably learn a lot of that from the media, and how people of color and how, you know, other types of people are represented. And then we learn and we think that everyone who is like, who is a man of color is going to hurt us, or everyone who, you know, is any sort of minority or, you know, not a white man is
somehow other, not,
yes, and then
not
they
a
all
subhuman.
Are going to act the same way, and that they're dangerous, or that, there.
It's something, it's just very problematic, and of course really horrible, but I think as part, you know, I saw a lot of young, I think I saw quite a few young people there, and there's, which was good to see lots of different people there, And I think that's part of being intersectional. I think intersectional feminism is that this is an issue for you. All issues that involve treating that are involved in hurting other humans. You know, it's not just women, and intersectional feminism recognizes that previous waves of feminism have definitely been, you know, geared towards privileged white women.
Right.
And I think the new wave that's talking about intersectionality is trying to get past that. But all of these things, this rally that we went to, and talking about the media and representation and talking about rape culture, all of these things are part of intersectional feminism, which I consider myself to be an intersectional feminist.
Yeah. And Emran?
Yep.
What was I saying? How do you think that this case and kind of just racial profiling and gender in general, and kind of the problems that people are starting to talk about, do you think the media plays into that?
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, in terms of this particular case, I mean, something that struck me about it is that it is really an issue of an intersectional issue, because if you think about the law Stand Your Ground and its relation to masculinity and how it seems to kind of present, in my opinion, a kind of a hyper-masculine kind of an ideal of like standing your ground. But what's interesting is that only certain men have access to that masculinity or that ideal, and it happens to be usually white men. And so I think the media plays a role in these kinds of issues, because like we were talking about before with the Bechdel test and whatnot, you know, the power of a movie or of a video game is storytelling and actually humanizing people and characters who we don't know, you know, and who we aren't. And so when we don't see these characters and these stories and these human real stories in our media, then we don't have that empathy, which is so necessary in situations like this. And on the reverse end, as somebody who isn't represented, well, then I don't feel like my experiences and my humanity are being valued by the society in which I live, which has, you know, terrible self-confidence issues, but also has consequences for how people interact with each other in day-to-day life. And so, yeah, I think the media is so powerful because it can show us people's lives that we don't understand and don't experience. And if it doesn't show us those things, then it's robbing us of such a valuable opportunity.
Yeah, that was very eloquently worded, much better than the question that prompted it for me. And you were kind of talking about masculinity and how that relates to Stand Your Ground. Do you think that masculinity is relevant to feminism, and how do you think it's relevant to feminism, and how is it relevant?
Yeah, we actually have a new film from same director as Misrepresentation, Jennifer Siegel Newsom. Her new film is called The Masculine, and it's about American masculinity and its impacts on boys and a larger kind of idea of gender. Because what ends up happening in our culture is you have like two extremes. You have the ideal of hyperfemininity on one end and the ideal of hypermasculinity on the other end. And in the end, it's a lose-lose situation because nobody's really allowed to be who they are. No one is ever at just one thing, you know, and no one is ever just one idea. But so boys feel like are being pressured to represent themselves in one way, and girls are being pressured to represent themselves in another way. And in the end, none of us are feeling completely whole. And so I think in that way, it is definitely an issue of feminism. And I think greater than that, whenever 50% of the world is not fully included in society or not fully included in our day-to-day lives, well, then all of us, all of humanity is really missing out on 100% of our potential and our possibilities and what we could be doing as people, you know. So I think,
yeah,
of course, so feminism is an issue for everyone.
So thank you very much, Emran. We've been talking with Emran Siddiqui from Misrepresentation, and this has been a show about intersectional feminism, you know, a very broad topic, as it should be. I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Gabby Farrell.
Thank you very much for listening to our show.
Thank you for listening to us.